first on this program. Yes, folks, Obama had, or in fact personally assassinated Scalia, and we now have a martyr of the right. But that's not the only count against him. According to my next guest, he's greatly admired by North Korea's very young leader, Kim Jong-un. You might remember Obama's slogan back in 2008, "Yes, we can." For Kim Jong-un, his slogan is, "Yes, I can." And that attitude is, well, frustrating attempts to calm down the nuclear saber-rattling in Northern Asia. Peter Hayes, Honorary Professor, Centre for International Security Studies at Sydney Uni, and also Director of the Nautilus Institute in Berkeley, California. Peter's in Australia at the moment. He joins us on his mobile from the north coast of New South Wales. Peter, welcome back to our little wireless program. In early Jan, you wrote that unlike 2015, this year was going to be a much more proactive year for the North Korean leader. They've just tested another nuclear weapon. Since then, they've launched a satellite. They're preparing or promising to launch more. Why the recent burst of activity?
Well, good evening, Philip. I guess Kim Jong-un has been, you know, on the job now, learning on the job for 4 years plus. And if he doesn't show to the rising generation, the young generation of North Korea, that he can really deliver on some form of economic growth that's worth having, plus the strength of having nuclear weapons that will enable the North to stand up against the United States, against South Korea, against Japan, even against Russia and China, then he can't hope to really endure. But if he can do those two things at the same time, which they call Byung-jin, then he could, you know, last a very long time, and he could exercise veto power, in effect, over a great deal of regional affairs for, you know, decades, not just years to come.
So, Peter, what do you make of reports in today's press that North Korea is set to deploy a missile with nuclear strike potential? Might that not be South Korean propaganda?
Well, I think that they do have crude nuclear devices that have a reasonable probability of going off. If you look at the number that they've let off, two of them have actually worked, so, you know, 50% plus reliability. Their long-range rockets, they've fired six over since 1998. So, you know, that's over 18 years, one every 3 years, of which two have worked, two under Kim Jong-un's reign, incidentally. But again, it's not a very highly reliable delivery means. So at this point, you'd have to say that the only place that they really know they can let off a nuclear weapon is in North Korea. That has some military utility, but it's primarily a weapon of psychological warfare for coercion and compellence, not deterrence or defense at this point. That said, it, I think, helps Kim Jong-un as a young leader appear to be very hard-line as he goes into this first Congress of the party for 30 years in May. And I think the bang on January 6th, followed by the launch on February the 7th, which incidentally was preceded by an expanded party meeting on February the 3rd, where he basically said, "Bureaucrats, look out. If you get in my way, you know, you're toast. I'll either execute you or move you out of Pyongyang." He knows what he's up against, and in a system as rigid and dogmatic and conservative as North Korea, basically he, I think, you know, has to break things in order to change things, and he's moving pretty quickly to do exactly that and consolidate his power and move on.
So he's not just a pretty face. Now, what do you make of Western reaction, media reaction, political reaction to recent events? There's a lot of talk today about tougher sanctions.
Well, North Korea, of course, has been under sanctions, Philip, you know, for, well, since the Korean War, basically, unilateral American sanctions and international sanctions since the first nuclear test, which have been progressively strengthened. But, you know, the reality is that North Korea occupies a location in the relations between the great and middle powers in Northeast Asia, which gives them a good deal of space. And the more that the United States and South Korea lean on the North, the more in many respects they make China and indeed Russia feel uncomfortable. And that doesn't mean that they'll back some of the more egregious violations of international rules and procedures that North Korea undertakes, but they certainly won't bring about North Korea's collapse. So, you know, there's a lot of, well, I won't call it bloviating, but there's a fair amount of posturing going on.
Do you know, I think you're the first guest ever to use the word bloviate, and it's one of my favourites. I must get you on more often. LNL on RN, on air, online, on your pod, and we're talking to Peter Hayes about North Korea. Now, let's go back to the New Year's speech, full of references to youth power. I'd like you to deconstruct this a bit, because this youth power stuff is really interesting.
Yeah, it's actually brand new. No, there was no reference to youth power by his father Kim Jong-il or his grandfather Kim Il-sung. And of course, youth does not necessarily mean the same thing in North Korea as it does to us. When we think of youth in Australia, we think of, you know, young people down at Bondi, you know, bronzed in the sun in their bikinis and in their bodies. But in North Korea, youth means someone roughly between the age 25, 30 to 60. You become an adult really at the age 60, 61. That's when you should be listened to. So he's really talking about a generation of his own age. He's now 32, up to about 45, 47, maybe 50 years old. And they in turn are displacing the gerontocrats, the old leadership who hold positions of power. They're in a hurry. They know that time is ebbing away. And that generation were his age when this whole confrontation began 20 years ago. So, you know, he really needs to move things around in order to ensure that that generational change occurs in a way that serves that generation's interests and thereby his. He doesn't control everything like his father did. You know, things are more complicated in Korea now because roughly two-thirds of the economy is actually already marketized. You know, that's a huge change. There are many changes like that.
And, successfully marketized?
Well, you know, it's not a growing economy in the Western sense, but it's certainly got incremental growth in the service sector. The military sector is, you know, well protected and reasonably well off, although its conventional forces are probably dwindling and suffering because of the investment in the nuclear high-tech stuff. And the underground sort of corrupt black economy, which is partly informal across border small time and partly very large operations run by the intel, the military, is in pretty good shape. And that, of course, is in close cooperation with counterparts in Japan and in China and Russia. So, you know, there are really three different economies and they extract rent from all of them. And that isn't going to go away. It's a relatively stable situation.
So a lot of people would have labored over every word, every nuance in the youth power speech. And, you know, it's rhythmic. It comes back to the same notion again and again and again as he reinforces what, as you say, is a new notion.
Well, you know, there is in the West been long an argument amongst the punditry and indeed amongst some policymakers that North Korea is going to collapse. And, you know, every 5 years they update that forecast and say, well, it hasn't collapsed yet, but it will in the next 5 years. And you'd think after 20, 25 years of evidence that it isn't going to collapse, you'd, you know, get around to dealing with it. And that's the problem. The United States essentially doesn't want to deal with North Korea, but isn't going to go away.
There's a lot of bloviation in the U.S., isn't there, towards Korea?
Well, I don't count the Obama administration out completely in two respects. They haven't started a war. That's a good thing, because a war in Korea would have been truly a catastrophe, not just for Korea, but for the whole region, including Australia, because it's one of our biggest trading and investment partners. And they have probed North Korea. They've put pressure on China. But realistically, in the run-up to a presidential campaign of the kind that Bruce Shapiro was just talking about, you're not going to see this White House take the slightest risk, given what they've already done with Cuba and Iran, to the running prospects of any Democratic candidate. So I think, you know, things are on hold until after the next U.S. presidential election, as far as the North Koreans concerned.
I haven't actually listened with sufficient detail to the bloviations from the Republicans, but there must be some nonsense being spoken in their ranks about the future in North Korea?
Some. I mean, Trump's made a few silly comments, but I think the reality is that North Korea, you know, unlike other places where they can, you know, have loose lips and vent hot air, North Korea actually really is a dangerous adversary, and there are 40,000 American troops on the line. I think the U.S. military, you know, can quietly whisper in ears and basically tell people to put a plug in it, because you just don't screw around in that context. So I don't think you'd see a huge shift in policy under a Democrat or a Republican. The problem is they just don't have a policy. They just don't know how to deal with it. And the reality is you can't deal with it unless you're willing to go beyond Korea, North Korea, beyond the Korean Peninsula. You've really got to have some sort of comprehensive security strategy and institution building in Northeast Asia in concert with China.
Well, let me ask you now, is China changing its views about what was a well-behaved junior partner?
Well, China finds North Korea very irritating. It's a useful thorn in the American side. It keeps the United States tied down in the Korean Peninsula, which also happens to be a buffer between Japan, which they are quite worried about, a resurgent militarism, and even the prospect of nuclear weapons in Japan down the line. So they actually really want the United States in the region. At the same time, they don't want the United States, you know, in their face, particularly when it comes to the Taiwan Straits area. So, and South China Sea and the territorial dispute. So, you know, China isn't going to abandon North Korea. To collapse North Korea would be strategically insane for China, because it would actually destroy South Korea, which is one of the largest investors and traders with China, which keeps the Chinese Communist Party stable at the moment, or relatively so, to the extent that it is. So, you know, there are really strict limits on what the Chinese can do. And since 1991, when they failed to induce Washington to cross-recognize Pyongyang, and when they, in turn, recognized South Korea, the North Koreans have regarded the Chinese as traitors. And so there's absolutely no love lost between the two. It's strictly pragmatic, and it's all about the money.
Now, I revealed earlier that Obama knocked off Scalia, but he's an amateur compared to Kim, because he's been mowing down his officials in a series of purges.
Well, one has to be careful in that regard, Philip. You know, North Korea is not a friendly or nice place. For decades, in fact, for millennia, orthodox courtly politics in Korea and now in North Korea is a dangerous game. But if you look at the number of executions of high-level officials since Kim Jong-un came to power, it actually is not much different to what happened under his predecessors. What was different was the killing of his uncle 2 years ago late in the year. That was done very publicly. That was a pronouncement really to China that Kim Jong-un is in charge, this guy who, you know, is too big for his boots and has been sacrificed.
We've lost you for a moment, so can you hit your phone for a sec? Today we've seen reports that the White House thinks China will agree to new sanctions against North Korea, and the UN human rights expert may recommend that Kim be charged with crimes against humanity. None of this means a damn thing to Kim, I should assume.
Well, you know, Kim really is going to go his own way at this point. He's not required by any diktat or any economic imperative at this point to simply capitulate to American or anyone else's demands. He can continue for a very long time building up an increasingly potent nuclear weapons force that actually can hit somewhere. He'd have to, you know, test a few reentry vehicles and other things along the way, but that's where he's heading in the next 5-10 years if something isn't done about it. That is with, I have to say, within reach of the great powers if they reshape the strategic landscape so that his own calculus shifts. They could still, I think, bring North Korea back into the fold of non-nuclear states, but they'd have to actually provide something to Kim Jong-un that's actually worth that trade. And that is the only thing that would do that, Philip, is essentially some level of recognition engagement at the leadership level that Kim Jong-un is the leader and will be the leader.
The calm, considered views of Peter Hayes. Peter is Honorary Professor, Center for International Security Studies at Sydney University here and Director of the Nautilus Institute in Berkeley, California. A little bit of music, and then we're going to see why Hillary is in a bit of bother with some young feminists.